My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walter Hagrids, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about the West becoming a source of war in the future. Hi, Walter. Why are we talking about this topic today? Like, what inspired us to talk about this?
Hi, Dario. Well, just the general tendency of the West, of course, that is very worrisome, but specifically two articles that I sent you earlier this week about my beloved the Netherlands, my beloved country that I haven't lived in for the past 29 years, but whose news I still follow. And there has been a very clear decline in the way that the Netherlands views itself in terms of peace and war. And these two articles that I sent you, that maybe we can look at later on in a bit more detail, basically are claiming that the Netherlands is halfway towards war, presumably with Russia. And this is a very concerning dynamic because we're getting to a stage that we talk ourselves into becoming the aggressor on the world stage. And that, of course, could have disastrous consequences.
So when it comes to this topic of war, it makes sense to look at the world right now and see, okay, where is there actually a war happening? And so I think we can easily say that there's a war happening between Russia and Ukraine. And there's also, I mean, here we already have to be a bit more careful because we're not talking about state actors or quasi-state actors in that sense, right? But Israel and Gaza, there's a clear armed conflict happening. I think my...
Organized violence might be.
Yeah, I think my university professors would be very proud of me for saying an armed conflict. But one topic that wasn't on my radar until this morning when I listened to it on the news, and apparently it has been brewing for some days already, is between India and Pakistan, right? So there was a deadly attack in Kashmir a few days ago where about 26 people died. And this is obviously kind of by the Indian government being branded as a terrorist attack. Others might label it as a rebel attack. I'm just going to say it was organized violence or an armed conflict. And this has slowly but surely escalated a little bit into a tit for tat between India and Pakistan, where there was a reaction by India, then Pakistan said, oh, we're going to boycott all your products, no more trade between us. And then India basically yesterday announced that or mandated that all Pakistani citizens had to leave India. Which that to me kind of reminded me of a Trumpian move almost on all of this. And then the big question that the German media basically posed this morning was, are we heading into war, Balder? Do we need to be concerned about yet another war?
No. The simple answer, which is an answer that can be given at many times over the past 30 years or so when these moments have happened between Pakistan and India, the two will not go to a full-blown war. For the simple reason that the cost of that would be way too high since both of them have nuclear arsenals. And so conventional warfare is very limited in that sense because if you do go to war and you have too much success, then nuclear war becomes inevitable and that would be disastrous for everyone involved. So the simple answer to that is no.
Then what do you think about this Trumpian aspect that I'm interpreting into this, right? Is that I'm not sure whether this would have been possible, let's say 5 years ago, when we saw the last time the tensions between India and Pakistan kind of were high, that this is something that I think usually would have been condemned by the West, right? But now the fact that I barely heard about it this week tells me that there weren't Western politicians outraged by either move or expressing a deep concern for the situation between Pakistan and India. It seems like the West is first of all very much inward looking at the moment, looking at its own problems, and that certain behaviors by the West have normalized the behavior that we're seeing by Modi by expelling all Pakistani nationals from India. I mean, I think that's a rather radical move.
Yeah, so that is a very interesting thing. You mentioned a few things here. That bit about the West not reacting is, of course, once again a sign of something that we've been analyzing throughout the years, namely the West is no longer sees itself as a policeman in the world. And you're absolutely right. If this had happened in the late 1990s, for example, the West would immediately call for both parties to come to the table, to be reasonable. The UN would be activated. I mean, the UN has made a statement, but nobody cares about the UN anymore because it no longer has the power because it no longer has Western support in the way that it did. So you're absolutely right that the lack of reaction from the West and from transnational organizations is once again a clear bit of evidence that we are heading towards anarchy. Now, I don't think it's a bad thing that the West is declining in power, but anarchy is scary, right? It is scary that we no longer have a global community where people actually can say, hang on, this is wrong. Let's calm down. Let's not make things worse than they need to be. So that's the first thing you mentioned, and I fully agree with that. The other aspect is that, yes, because the West has been relatively aggressive in its own behavior, in its own language, because it feels fearful, it feels that it's being threatened by often ghosts, right? They don't know really what threatens them, but the West feels threatened. And Trump very much plays with this. They open the door to lots of countries to say, okay, now we're going to play the same game. And Modi, with a very clear political agenda, is saying, okay, this is actually relatively useful. I can create this kind of jingoistic reaction by India, by my country, that allows me to achieve political gain, that allows me to achieve domestic goals. The thing that needs to be said there is that the Indian media also very happily, and maybe the Indian public, I have to be a bit careful with talking about India and Pakistan. I've never been to Pakistan. I have been to India, and I have a warm heart for the country, but I'm definitely not an expert. But you can see over the past few decades that India, the Indian population, is very ready and very happy in some ways to become aggressive in their demeanor, right? Specifically towards Pakistan. So when this happened in 2019, there was a similar situation, and I had Indian students in my class. They were convinced that at that moment, India and Pakistan were at war, whereas the only thing that had happened, which is bad enough, is India had struck a camp in Pakistan, and that Pakistan had downed an Indian fighter. That was a bad skirmish. That's bad. That's violence. That is bad. People died. But it definitely wasn't war. But the Indian students in my class were convinced that their country was already at war. And that's kind of the jingoistic language that you can observe now in the Indian media as well. And that is very, very concerning.
And that's the focus of today's episode, is that basically the escalating rhetoric that we're looking at. Because, I mean, you've had these worries with the Netherlands. I had them with Germany. Just because I'm talking right now, we're going to start with the example of Germany, where it basically happened exactly a month ago that suddenly the German intelligence services and basically the military, right? And the military here has its own university, its own academy. And they basically went onto a talk show together, onto this whole media tour, warning that Russia is ready to attack NATO in 2030 and that we have to prepare for that. And I pride myself in knowing a few things about international relations, thought to myself, how irresponsible is it that these people, who are some of the like main experts in Germany when it comes to security, are purposefully going out there on a media tour, basically warning of war and preparing the population that we really need to step it up now, basically calling for war. I mean, I've referenced this a few times now in the past episodes, this whole meme that if you know a little bit about history, you're just walking around all day long nowadays, basically warning everyone, don't you see the signs? But excuse you, if this is happening, right, in German media and the military is preparing us for a war, doesn't this ring a few bells about World War One?
Exactly. I'm so happy that you mentioned World War One. This was not planned between you and me. But this morning in class, lecturing at university, I exactly referenced World War One. So let's look at World War One for a second, and then we go back to Germany and the Netherlands in 2025. World War One was not... So most students who learn a little bit about history know about how it started. The powder keg got exploded by the assassination of the Archduke. That is something that most people are aware of. But what is not sufficiently analyzed is in how the 20, 30 years before that, there was a slow build-up towards an inevitable war. And if it hadn't happened in 1914, it would have happened in 1915 or 1916. We created a situation where war was inevitable. And that was because you had these two power blocks that maintained some kind of power balance, But because they were both armed to the teeth, and I'm going to reference that that phrase a little bit later, both sides were armed to the teeth with three major powers on each side, that at some point was always going to explode. Now, if we now go to 2025, NATO is exactly following that kind of pattern. And when I say NATO, Western countries, I don't know if in 2031 NATO will still exist, but Western countries will absolutely still be there. And they are now moving towards a world where they make it inevitable that war exists. This was, by the way, one of my complaints that we've discussed in the past about the Biden administration telling Putin before the invasion of Ukraine, we know you're going to invade, we know you're going to invade, and we're going to punish you. Remember, we're going to punish you the moment you invade. We don't know exactly what you're going to do, but we know you're going to start a war. That is not the act of an administration that wants to avoid war. That's the act of someone who wants to win the war. And I would very much like my country to avoid war. Thank you very much.
Before we look at what your country and my country have been saying in particular, I do want to throw out a quick book recommendation there, exactly about World War One, and it's The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914 by Christopher Clark, because it analyzes exactly that, right? Because we, at least internationally as a German, if you tell anyone you're a German and then somebody gets to history, it's always kind of said that Germany started two wars, right? And then the Germans always respond with the joke, haha, it was always an Austrian, right? First it was Franz Ferdinand, and then it was Adolf Hitler. And with regards to World War II, I think people can agree that I'm pretty sure most people will agree that it was Germany who started that. But with World War I, it was very much just kind of each country unwittingly stumbling into it because they weren't able to analyze their own behavior and predicting that, hey, if all of you arm yourselves to the teeth, you might run into a problem here, because if you have a big weapon, you might want to start using that weapon at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. So World War One was an absolute disaster. It was horrific for everyone involved. Just the number of deaths is astounding. Also, the incompetence of the military was astounding, by the way, from all sides, but certainly from the French and the British side. Germany's gotten a bad rap in the First World War. Not that they're not to blame. I mean, all major powers were to blame for what happened, exactly what you said. But the Second World War and the fact that Germany lost the First World War meant that the victors could claim a triumphant victory for freedom and everything else. And especially after the Second World War, okay, let's make the First World War basically a prelude to the Second World War, right? Whereas the First World War, and that's really important to understand, was not a moral war. It was not about the good versus the evil. It was not a one where one side was inherently dark and the other side was inherently light. It was a war between two equally responsible power blocks. And unfortunately, yeah, Germany now has to kind of fight this fight in the sense of saying, hey, the First World War, it was not the Second World War. There's a major difference here, right? The 2025 situation, though, is scarily similar in some ways, because obviously we, the West, are convinced that we're the good guys and we have identified the bad guys. Sometimes it's not clear whether we're talking about Russia or China, but mostly Russia. And that then gets confirmed by their invasion of Ukraine and all that. People forget that Ukraine is not exactly the same as the European Union or NATO. We're talking about completely different beasts here, both in terms of ideology, but also in terms of military capabilities. We have identified the bad guys, but at the same time, we are feeling fearful. We are terrified as the West. And that fear leads us to, exactly like the book that you referenced, we're sleepwalking into a situation where we need the sense of security. And for some reason, because we, with all the respect, we're kind of idiots, we seem to think that security comes from bigger defense spending. We seem to think that security comes out of more tanks, more planes, more military capabilities. Out of that, we're creating a situation where there's a very, very likely future where we are the ones who are going to actually start the war. We are the ones who are going to pull the trigger.
It almost seems like we are, right, with World War One, kind of not being a moral war and everyone just sleepwalking into it, World War II very much being a moral war, is that there's this need that, hey, let's do it a third time with both motives. Because the West right now is feeling that moral superiority, while at the same time, everyone is doing everything, so we are equally armed and kind of locked into this arms race as before World War One, right?
To be clear, if we took a time machine to 1913 or 1914, the Germans would be convinced that they're the good guys, right? And the British would be convinced that they were the good guys, or the French. So just like we are convinced that we're the good guys, that's not an objective position. It is a scary part of this, because if you believe you're the good guys and there's some evil dark forces, which for the French in 1914 would have been the Germans, and now for us is the Russians, or vice versa, for the Germans it would be the French, you create a situation where essentially you feel that the only way out is to defend yourself militarily against that threat, not understanding that the world is complex, and that if you start arming further than a certain level of reasonable defense, you actually create patterns, you create a reaction from the Russians, but also inside of your own society, where you significantly lower the threshold required to actually go to war. That is the point. If you really think about what starts a war, it is almost always a long process of slow steps that lower the thresholds where someone can pull the trigger. And what you want to do is you want to raise the thresholds. You want to make it more difficult for every side to actually go to war. Russia has an enormous threshold already. Do you know what the threshold is? The threshold is that Russia spends this year, only because of the war in Ukraine, this is a highly unusual situation, spends $150 billion on its military. There's no way that it can continue spending that military in the future. It is something, a ridiculous amount, something like 50% of its governmental budget goes to the military at the moment. Whereas NATO spends 10 times as much, 1.5 trillion. Russia knows this, and Russia knows that it cannot win a war against NATO. That has nothing to do with further defense spending. It doesn't require 5% of our GDP going to NATO. It is simply the current situation without any increases, where NATO outspends Russia by a factor of 10 to 1. Russia doesn't need a bigger threshold not to go toward NATO. They don't want, what would they get out of it? Why would they attack Western Europe? What would be their purpose? Why would they attack Poland? What would be their purpose? There is nothing that they can get out of it. It would only lead to destabilizing the Kremlin and Putin's position of power. However, for us, the threshold is much lower, because we are on the other side and we outspend Russia 10 to 1. And so we already have a relatively low threshold when it comes to violence. The only threshold that we used to have and that we're now breaking down is a originally deep understanding that war is bad and that we should not try to engage in violence and that we should not think in belligerent terms, that we should try to overcome conflict through dialogue, through communication, through a reasonable interaction, right? And unfortunately, now we're going completely in a different direction. We're saying, no. Defense is the way to go. The military is the way to go. And that's scary as anything.
Right. So as you were speaking, I quickly fact-checked you, right? Just to make sure with the numbers, and I kind of wanted to confirm basically the number of the budget. And while doing so, I stumbled across a Politico article. And boy, are we deep in the Western bubble. Boulder, are you ready for this?
Hit me.
So basically, the title is, right, this article is from Politico, February 12th. And I assume this is where, right, when you first heard about the number of 150 billion, right, US dollars of Russian defense spending. And this article is titled, Russian Defense Spending Overtakes Europe, Study Finds.
That is insanity. That is complete insanity. There is no way that Russian defense spending overtakes Europe.
Well, when it comes to overtakes Europe, right, it obviously depends a little bit on what you define as Europe. I mean, because so far, right, you said, hey, it's definitely like right, NATO obviously outspends Russia. I mean, just today there was this news item that Republicans want to add $150 billion to the US military budget, right? So that's a whole Russian budget. But then you have this graph in this article, and this is fascinating. It's basically saying Russia, in a different league. And then it shows you basically a nice little graph of the years of defense spending, and then the percentage, right? And it's very nice because Russia is basically the graph that's the highest, and then because it's based on the percentage of GDP, and for Russia is spending 6% of its GDP on the military, right? Not to confuse with the budget, what you said earlier, right? And then the second biggest one is Poland, and then the UK, and then Germany, and France, and Italy. Yeah, all listed individually underneath Russia.
Okay, no, then I'm on board. I know that Russia outspends each of them individually, but to be clear, only now because of the war in Ukraine. If you go back 5 years, Germany had basically the same expenditure as Russia when it came to defense, right? But that's exactly the point, right? So yeah, if you take it individually, then Russia spends a bit more. But you know why? Because they are actually fighting an actual war in Ukraine, not because they're preparing to invade Poland, right? It is highly disturbing how an article like the one that you just cite, and this whole discussion around this, is basically pushing us into this direction that we're kind of inherently emotionally convinced that war is going to happen at some point without actually thinking about the rational process of what's going on. Russia has nothing to gain from invading Europe. Why would they? What? I still am waiting for someone to explain to me. There might be some case, and I'm definitely not convinced by that either, but if you are going to look at European countries, if I lived in the Baltic states, I would say, hey, here's a large Russian minority. Russia could play the same game that they played with Georgia, for example, saying, hey, we're going to annex a part because we have to defend Russians. Even that, I think, is a huge leap for Russia because that's incredibly dangerous to do. But okay, maybe. But there is absolutely no reason why Russia, Putin, the Kremlin, would ever want to send tanks into Poland. What would be the end result? What are they going to achieve? Explain that to me. Nobody can, right? But what I can see is a situation where NATO at some point is so convinced that they are the good guys and they are ready, and that if they don't do it, Russia is going to do it tomorrow, that today NATO pulls the trigger and says, okay, now we're going to start strikes against Russia.
Sorry, I have to go back to this article one more time just because it's so outrageous. And the fact that this is published on Politico is almost criminal. So Lucia McKinsey, I'm shaming you publicly for this. Maybe we should do an episode on her just like we did on Simon Tistel from The Guardian. Because in this, right, because so we already established that it's talking about the percentage, right, based on GDP. It can't even compare to that, right? Again, I want to remind you, the headline read, Russian defense spending overtakes Europe, study finds. First of all, just because you know the think tank world out there, what do you think, which think tank may have done a study like this?
Is it American? Is it an American think tank that we're talking about? Or
yes, I think so.
Is it the Heritage Foundation or Cato or Brookings?
So first of all, I was wrong. It's European. It's in London. I just assumed it must be American because they published something
Chatham,
like this.
Chatham House?
No, it's the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Right.
I mean, it's also, I think it's sometimes helpful for listeners to understand which think tank is on which side of the world, and also on where they stand ideologically. So they did this study, and Lucia McKinsey, in this report that's talking about the study, basically says that, remember that Russian defense spending is 145 or 150 billion US dollars. European defense spending is 457 billion US dollars. And the only way they can come to the conclusion that Russia is outspending Europe is by looking at the purchasing power parity terms. This is straight up propaganda.
That is ridiculous. That is absolutely insane.
And people are reading this headline and are preparing for war.
But even if you do that, then as you said before, it's still it's only if you look at percentages, because people have to realize that as a percentage of GDP, It may look impressive, but then you realize that the European Union has a GDP, I don't actually know the factor, but many factors higher than Russia, right? So obviously, this is going to be...
I mean, Germany alone has a GDP twice the one of Russia. I mean, I think we there was a time where we always compared the Russian GDP to the Italian one, but then because of all the sanctions and so on, it dropped down to the one of Spain. Yeah, it's... I mean, I'm sorry, but Russia is not a match for Spain in that sense.
But you, here's the problem, right? And that this kind of article, this kind of thinking creates a mindset for those who are not fully aware of the complexity of international relations, where it becomes okay for them to hear politicians say, we need to up our budget, we need to start preparing for war with Russia, we need to defend ourselves. Because they just hear these little fragments that they then take in as facts. And over time, incrementally, that leads to a society that is basically geared up for war. That's a society that is going to be one day just ready for it. And once a society is ready for it, there is basically no longer a threshold. Emotionally ready, psychologically ready, militarily prepared. And at that moment, it just happens one day, right?
So we're already looking at an interplay of... right, the major security experts in Germany, the military and security services or intelligence services. We're looking at the media, who are super ready for war. And then we're also looking at politicians. Well, I don't know if the Dutch king can be considered a politician, right, because he's more the head of state. But I think people do listen to him, important enough. And this is then when you sent this article to me, and I'm going to quote this, whether it makes sense to the listeners and whether I'm going to quote it correctly, I'll leave up to you. But it basically says, Koning von der Nederland siegt tot de tanden tot mut bewappenen. Which, Walder, I don't know if I said that correctly, but it basically means the king of the Netherlands says we have to weaponize ourselves to the teeth, right? Yeah. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Yeah. A good effort. Let me just, not to offend our Dutch listeners, also do it once in my Dutch. Let me put it like that. It says, Koning vindt dat Nederland zich tot de tanden toe moet bewapenen. And which means, actually, the king believes that the Netherlands needs to arm itself, and I quote here, to the teeth. Right? And that conjures up this image of a pirate with a dagger in their teeth and a gun in one hand and a sword in another hand, ready, you know, fully weaponized, fully aggressive. And this follows a report from the day before where the internal security services of the Netherlands, the MIVD, produced their annual report where they say the Netherlands, and I'm quoting here, the Netherlands finds itself in a gray area between peace and war. Basically, we're not at peace and we're not at war, which is a different version of what Sweden said, or the Swedish prime minister said a while back. And it's a different version of German experts, right? It is essentially saying, look, we're not fully at war, obviously, because we're not shooting at the Russians and the Russians are not shooting at us. But we can't talk about peace either because there are cyber attacks. And there's propaganda, and we know that Russia is preparing for war against us. So we are neither here nor there. And that position, we're not at peace and we're not at war, is frustratingly dangerous. Because with that, at that moment, you no longer have a red line. You just slide into real war, right? Obviously, right now in 2025, we're not at war. The Netherlands, Germany, the European Union is not at war with Russia. Yes, they're mean to each other. Russia is mean to us, we're mean to them, and to be honest, you know, I think Russia deserves that the rest of the world's a little bit mean to them, because they should not have invaded Ukraine, and they are responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths on the Ukrainian battlefield. So, you know, I don't have any particular sympathy for Russia in this case, but it is completely obvious that we in Western Europe, in the European Union, in NATO, are not at war with Russia. And the moment we start saying, well, it's a little bit gray, is the moment that we no longer have that psychological threshold. And just step by step, we'll get to a situation where we actually start firing missiles at Moscow.
So here I have a question, and it's a very genuine one, right? Not one of those podcast questions, oh, Balder, let me set up a point here. Why are they doing this? So my theory would be, right, the EU, or well, the United States broke up with the EU. We've covered this point extensively, And so a month and a half ago, there were then all these efforts within the European Union. We've talked about this extensively to basically say, okay, we now need to become independent from NATO. We need to do our thing. And particularly the Germans announced a big big defense spending package, and Spain also now just upped their defense spending by a lot a few days ago. So is this rhetoric basically a whole media and communication campaign organized by politicians to kind of keep the population in line and keep them motivated to justify this defense spending? So in other terms, it's a foolish tactic by politicians to kind of get what they want, and they're not aware of the basically long-term implications of this, of a society getting ready for war, or is this just the normal Western bubble like effects that we've analyzed in the past? Because I want to believe that this is a tactic and they're just not aware of the long-term implications, because I don't know, that like that's me post-rationalizing things.
Well, my analysis would actually not that it's an explicit tactic, unfortunately. So if I'm, you know, even though that in some ways would be simpler, unfortunately, it's more of the general Western bubble. It's the incremental process. So one of the reasons why people from the outside often misunderstand international relations is that they attribute too much agency to specific actors. Right? They basically say, oh, this is a big plan. And sometimes that then leads to the literal conspiracy of the Illuminati control the world or whatever it is. Right? But very often, oh, no, Trump knows exactly what he's doing, or the European Union knows exactly what they're doing. Obviously, they don't. And I've seen that with my own eyes. I see it quite regularly, and I don't want to offend anyone that I'm working with. But it's not that great. They're not that clever. They're not that intelligent. They're very intelligent people, but they're not that intelligent. That's what I'm trying to say, right? They're not. It's not as if they are like, there are people in the European Union or NATO who are pulling all the strings and are in complete control of these dynamics. I think you have to look at it through incremental change that goes all the way back to, if you like, the war on terror, where we already kind of woke up to a world that was dangerous. Terrorism is a very unpleasant concept, and it was threatening us. And then that goes to a world that is sliding away from us, making us more fearful. Then you've got in the first term Donald Trump saying, hey, NATO needs to put more money on the table. And initially our reaction is a little bit negative to that, but slowly in our mind it starts creeping in. Maybe we need to reach 2%, because it's true that the United States is putting a lot of money on the table. Maybe Europe needs to do the same. So you see a slow, uncontrolled process that drives us into a certain direction. And then in 2025, you get to a place where you look at the world, you look at Gaza, Israel, but specifically you look at Ukraine and an actual war that's taking place with an aggressive, violent, destructive Russia. And you say, okay, the world is horrifying at the moment. We can't control it anymore. We thought we were the masters of the world, but we are not the masters in the world. We need to do something. And who can then make use of that? Those organizations that actually are already, that already exist to fulfill that gap. The MIVD, the Dutch intelligence agency, internal, and then the AIVD, the external intelligence agency, the experts that you cited from Germany, their job is there exactly to do this, to warn for the worst case scenarios, to warn for the things that could go horribly wrong. And now they have a free playing field, because people are already kind of accustomed to thinking negatively about Russia, thinking that defense spending maybe needs to go up, etc., etc. Then on top of that, you've got some arms producers, weapon producers that are knocking on the door and say, hey, we've heard that you're concerned about Russia. We can offer you some really good deals for new technology, new planes, new tanks, new ammunition. Great. Now, then you've got politicians who also don't really have an answer to the world and know that they are on kind of a sinking ship of the Western world order. They say, okay, we need to give something to our voters. What do we do? We're going to tell them that we're going to buy more military equipment, so then they feel protected again against this evil anarchic world order. It's no one specifically in control, but slowly certain actors get the room to predict the worst case scenarios and they get taken seriously, something that wouldn't have happened in the 1990s when the whole Western society was looking differently at the world, at Russia, at themselves. So my explanation is unfortunately a complex one, slow, incremental change, where at some point it basically explodes. And now it is exploding in front of us.
It's also less satisfying because it means that we are somewhat part of the problem. It would be so much easier to say that this is just evil Friedrich Merz who needs to justify his military spending to a German public that doesn't like spending money. Right there, because and this is obviously how conspiracy theories start, because for me the main thought was, why are they all doing it at the same time? This seems so coordinated, but it's more, I assume the process is more, oh, the German intelligence agencies, they were warning of this. Obviously, we, the Dutch, we also have those cool insights, so let us warn from this as well.
And they are communicating with each other all the time, certainly within European context. They're also getting signals from Brussels and from their own capitals that politicians want to make sure that they are protecting their own country. They get rewarded for basically worst case scenarios. And that happens all at once because they're all in the same kind of dynamic, right? They're all part of that same historical evolution of the past 30 years or so, where you get to this place where you as an intelligence agency, you as a military expert, you as a politician, get rewarded for actually assuming the worst. And by assuming the worst, you are creating the worst. And even the Dutch king, look, I'm sure that he means what he says. He is concerned. He sees himself as, I mean, I don't have any particular sympathy or lack of sympathy for him. But I would very much assume that he's generally concerned about the Netherlands. He sees the Netherlands as a country that needs to be protected. And he gets intelligence briefings from the MIVD. He gets intelligence briefings from politicians, from others who tell him, dear King, the Netherlands is under threat. And then he comes out and he makes a statement. We have to arm ourselves to the teeth. Not understanding that that statement itself is making it much more likely that in the future the Netherlands will be at war. Not because Russia attacks the Netherlands, but because the Netherlands, together with its Western allies, will be the belligerent party attacking Russia. And that is a movement that's going to be very difficult to stop. And I would just almost plead to everyone listening to this podcast, when this happens, give some pushback. Say, well, what is actually the analysis? What are you actually trying to say? Because I don't want my 9-year-old son to live in a world of World War III. Thank you very much.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the West being a source of war in the future. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I took a quote from the great Bertrand Russell, who said, "War does not determine who is right, only who is left."